This is an 8-iron, and it's a dead shank.
Wow.
Way right.
Oh, takes a hop off the path.
You got to be kidding me.
Very tough pitch shot right here. You got to hit it into the hill. One hop up and bite, and it's in.
Kind of like that.
Well, I would like to welcome to the Sub 70 podcast PGA Tour winner, Champions Tour winner, Scott McCarron. Scott, thanks for taking the time today. I greatly appreciate it.
You got it, Jason. Glad to be on.
Well, it's U.S. Open week, and I know you've done some TV analyst work in the past, so I'm going to ask, what are your thoughts on Shinnecock for this week? What kind of player do you think will play well, and sort of what is your overall opinion of the golf course?
Yeah, well, I did with Fox Sports 2, actually, U.S. Opens, and had a blast doing them. Shinnecock is a golf course I've played a few times, very difficult golf course. USGA, I'm sure, will be setting it up extremely hard, like they always do. Hopefully they've learned their lesson from last time and not really take it over the edge on some of the holes, which they did last time. But I'm looking at players, you know, guys that are coming in here and playing well. I mean, Dustin Johnson with a big win in Memphis last week. He seems to be firing all cylinders, got the number one ranking back. This is a golf course that's very long. He'll be hitting a lot of drivers. So I believe that he's going to probably play well. Jordan Spieth, another guy, you know, when he gets his putter going, he's almost unstoppable, and he seems to play so well in the majors. And then I think Justin Thomas got a little chip on his shoulder because just lost his number one ranking last week to, or this week, to Dustin Johnson. So I think he's going to have a good week as well.
Short game going to be huge. Does a guy like Phil have an advantage with the greens kind of being more of a roll-off anymore and having to have some chips as tough as those greens are to hit?
You know, I don't know. You know, Phil's obviously playing a lot better this year than he's played in the past. So he's certainly a guy that you can look at. But, you know, when you get up there in age, it's a little more difficult to win these major championships. And I don't know if, you know, Phil drives it straight enough to win a U.S. Open. You know, he hasn't proven that yet. And the Shinnecock is a golf course that you got to drive the ball in the fairway.
Well, let's get back to your golf game. Needless to say, since you've been on the Champions Tour, you've been on fire, six wins, really good play. What's been the key to that consistency that you've had since you've kind of came out to that tour?
Yeah, well, I've, you know, a lot of things I've been doing, with this gentleman named E.A. Tischler. And we started working about 3 hours ago, or excuse me, 3 years ago. And it was something that I needed to work on my game. I was kind of going down the wrong direction with my swing. And so before I got in the Champions Tour, E.A. Tischler and I started working together. And we started working on my posture and a few of the things in my golf swing just to get my body to swing more the way it wants to, more natural. And that's really been one of the biggest things for me, just to kind of get back into playing some good golf again. So, you know, I really did. I went and played web.com events before I got on the Champions Tour just to get ready, because I wasn't fully exempt on the PGA Tour my last year. And, you know, just trying to play competition as much as I can. And I also feel comfortable out the Champions Tour. I like it out there. I'm playing with the same guys that I came out on the PGA Tour with. And it's just been a lot of fun. So, you know, I have, if you put yourself in position to win a lot, you get more and more comfortable out there. And I think that just spurs on some, you know, even better golf. You see some of the best players on our Champions Tour getting in the hunt and getting in the mix quite often.
You kind of got to my next question, but I was just going to say, in my opinion, your golf swing looks better today than it probably ever has in your career. I'm 45 years old, so I've been watching golf, you know, my whole life. And to me, the position of the club that it's in, and I think your swing looks, I don't know, and tell me if I'm wrong, but I think it looks better than it's ever looked, even when you were playing the regular tour.
Well, I would agree. I think I'm hitting the ball better than I ever have. You know, I'm 52, and I believe I'm hitting the ball more solid. I'm in control of the golf ball more now at 52 than I was when I was 25, 26, 27. So certainly, you know, I tell people, you know, and Hale Irwin told me this, he played his best golf from 50 to 55. So, you know, why can't I? And I truly believe that I am swinging better than I ever have. And it's funny, though. I'll have people say, you know, they'll see me from three fairways over that haven't seen me for years. And they go, oh, I saw you. I knew that was your swing. Yeah, it's the same swing you had when you were 16. You know, so all this work that I'm doing on my swing, it's still basically the same type of motion.
Yeah, see, but to me, it looks tighter. The club looks like it's just in better positions. When I was kind of watching an old swing for doing the outline of this podcast. The work you're doing is good. I think your swing looks absolutely, like I said, truly looks as good as it's ever looked, if not better, in your career.
So. Well, thanks. I appreciate it. It's been a lot of hard work, and EA and I have worked really well together, and it's been a fun journey. And you know, you're always trying to learn, and that's one thing that's great about golf. You know, every day I'm going out there and trying to learn new things and trying to get better. And so it's a lot of fun.
Well, then last year, all that work pays off, right? You win a major on the Champions Tour, the Senior Players. Congratulations, first off, on that. And does that kind of a victory, does it have a different sense than the other victories you've had, even on the regular tour or regular wins on the Champions Tour? Does it feel different? Does it feel different coming down to the end? And how satisfying was it to get a major championship?
Well, you know, to get a major championship is big. I never got a major championship on the PGA Tour. I had a few opportunities. I really thought I was going to win the Masters at one time. I just loved that golf course. I felt really well there. It set up well for me. You know, and I had a couple opportunities and just never was able to get it to the house. So to get that major finally on the Champions Tour is big. You know, it's not quite as big as the regular tour, you know, as far as the notoriety and the media, but it still feels big to us as players. And it was a lot of fun to win at the Kays Valley, the Senior Players Championship, a great, great venue, great tournament. And I look forward to defending at Exmoor. And it's just one of those things that, you know, you're striving for, you're trying to win the big event. So it does feel a little bit bigger. You know, there's more media going into the event. Usually we have good galleries. They're usually at really good golf courses. And so it does feel a little bit bigger than maybe some of the other events.
Yeah. Exmoor is in our backyard. I'm out in Illinois, and, I've gotten to play there before, and I've heard nothing they've done some touches to it. It's an old Donald Ross. It's going to be a great test for you guys out there. It'd be a great golf course for you to defend on. So
yeah, I've heard a lot of good things about Exmoor.
Three more majors to go this season. Still, is it, When you're coming up, I kind of call it for you guys in this tour, especially the major season. I mean, you got quite a few of them coming, and then still three to go. Do you push harder that week, or do you actually have to be more patient? Because obviously, you win one, you want to get another one. How does is there any different in a mindset heading into major championship weeks?
You know, there is a little bit different mindset for majors on the Champions Tour as opposed to the PGA Tour, because most of our regular events on the Champions Tour are 3 days. And you got to put the pedal to the metal right on Friday morning because these guys are going low, and you know their golf courses you know, attribute to a lot of birdies. When we get to majors, we're 4 days, and so it's a little bit longer process. You got to be a little more patient. The golf courses are a little bit tougher. The conditions of the golf course seem to be a little bit harder, so you got to be a little more patient. You can't have that just, you know, go for broke attitude. And you know, take your picks and your spots where you can make some birdies, and when you got to make pars, you know, got to fire away from some of these flags because golf courses seem to be a little bit tougher during majors.
With a victory last year, you got to play in the Players Championship this year. I know it's not the result you wanted, but how much fun is it still in your 50s to go back and still compete against the guys in the PGA Tour? And how was that experience to kind of come back and play in, you know, that tournament on the PGA Tour? Does it spark anything that you still want to maybe play PGA Tour every now and then a little bit, or are you happy with just staying on the Champions Tour at this point for most of the time?
You know, it was actually a lot of fun. Going there, it was funny. I was like, God, am I going to know anybody? But once I got there, I knew everybody. I knew all the caddies. You know, it was almost like a kind of a homecoming to go back and play again. It was a lot of fun. Unfortunately, I didn't play very well the way I wanted to. Preparation was good. I felt like I was ready to go. Just didn't putt very well the first day at all. I can hardly wait to get that opportunity to go back. So it actually kind of sparked me to, you know, if I can win a couple majors, you know, over the next 4 or 5 years to get my opportunity to play a few more events on the PGA Tour, I feel that I can still compete out there. And so it's a lot of fun for me to go back there and you know, see how my game stands up to, you know, the best players in the world.
This is kind of a generic question without, you know, naming names or anything, but if there was not a Champions Tour, how many of the guys do you think, because I don't think people realize, and I'll preface the question this way, how good the guys in the Champions Tour still really are. I mean, these guys can really play. How many of those guys would still be exempt on the PGA Tour? Would there be a handful, or would it be shocking how many guys, if they could pick the events and the courses that set up well for them, would still be good enough to play the regular tour and keep a, let's just say, keep a card per se?
You know, I always said that there's probably about 20 guys that can still compete out in the Champions Tour. And, you know, the hardest thing with the Champions Tour, it seems to be, is just, is and the PGA Tour, is getting to 50. There's kind of some lull areas of that 45, 46 to 50. You know, guys start looking forward to the Champions Tour. Maybe they're not playing quite as much on the PGA Tour, you know, with family stuff or kids graduating or leaving, you know, all that stuff. But once the guys get to 50, it seems like they're sparked and spurned on to play some good golf. I think if there wasn't a Champions Tour, you might not have that lull at that 45, 46, 47. And guys would keep the pedal down and keep playing some great golf. And I wouldn't be surprised if we could have 20 guys out on the PGA Tour still competing.
Also, with getting close to the Champions Tour and kind of getting ready for that, I'm sure with the golf swing changes you made, you're also focused on fitness to get really strong. And my question is, in your 50s, has your workout routine had to change compared to your 30s or 40s? And what are you sort of doing to keep, you know, your golf muscles strong, to stay flexible? What's a sort of a workout week look for, you know, for you in a, during a week and then during an off week? Is there a difference?
You know, my workouts have changed a little bit. I started working with a guy named Greg McLean out of PFS in Arizona, and he worked with a lot of athletes, baseball players, football players, and golfers. And we focused more on mobility and meaning more stuff on the ground, doing bear crawls and stuff that, you know, you don't have to lift a lot of weight, but you got to be strong and flexible. And so I would say my workouts have changed a lot from lifting heavy weights to lifting lighter weights and doing more movements, all types of planes of movements. And that, I think, has helped me quite a bit. I feel stronger, a little bit leaner, and, you know, more flexible. And so those are the things that when you get older, you got to continue to do to be able to compete and play. And I actually feel like I'm hitting the ball farther now at 52 than I was, you know, back in the day when I was 30, 35. And I certainly have more control over it. And I think a lot of it's due just to the fact that I'm doing smarter things now in my workouts than maybe I was in my late 20s, early 30s.
Do you work out during the tournament week, or is that week just all about rest and reps?
No, I do. I work out. I'll do two workouts, one upper body, one lower body during the week. And then I'll do two mobility workouts, upper body, lower body. So there's four workouts. And then I'll do every day about a 20 to 30 minute type of warm up before I go out there and to get ready to play golf. So, you know, I'm doing something just about every day.
Well, on another topic, the Club Pro guy, who you and I both have a love for what that guy is doing on Twitter. And for people who don't know the Club Pro guy, it's a parody account of a golf professional with a noted career on the Mexican Mini Tour. And he's a legend in his own mind and, of course, with this. So my question is, how did you start following? And people should follow because it really is that funny. How did you start following it? And it's funny watching you play along with the swing advice he gives for the 747, you know, swing tips and all that stuff. So how did you find this account? And then how did you start essentially, quote unquote, taking it serious and playing along with it?
You know, I think I saw a few of his original tweets maybe about a year ago or so. And then I saw and listened to the first podcast he did. And I thought it was just, I mean, I thought it was hilarious. I mean, the stuff that he was throwing out there and the companies that he was throwing out there, the old school stuff, you know, I was like, this guy's, you know, done his homework. I mean, he's got to be an ex mini tour player, Club Pro guy, and a comedian and a comic writer. I mean, I thought the stuff was just hilarious. So, you know, I started following him and listening to some of the stuff he does, and a couple of buddies of mine, Jerry Foltz and Trip Eisenhower, played golf with him in Florida, and just couldn't say enough about Club Pro guy. They say he was a great guy. He was a blast. And so, you know, I just started playing along with it a little bit. And it's funny. I mean, some of the stuff is really, really funny. And certainly the 747 swing thought system is something I've really incorporated.
Nothing like just
swing thoughts on your backswing, four at the top, and seven on the downswing. And then
flick at it, right? Yeah, just aim right and flick at it. What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, and that was funny. I mean, when I did, when I met, it was really interesting. I'm at the Players' Championship and had to do a media day for 3 hours for the senior players when I was at the Players' Championship. And so I'm going through all these interviews and doing, media and in the media room. And all of a sudden I had a media official come up and says, "Hey, we've got one more interview. Club Pro guy wants to interview you." And I just thought that was hilarious. I mean, so yeah, I met him and we did a little interview right there in the media area. And it turned out to be really funny. I mean, when I said, at the last part, just flip it and, it's always going to go where you're not looking. I mean, that was pretty funny.
Well, yeah, and you deadpanned it so perfect that you're like taking this serious. And then when you're talking about the bass boat, like it will change your life if you finish last with the money. Like, I don't know if he is. He's got to be a comedian. I mean, like the stuff he comes up with that quick. And if you know golf, probably like the way like I've been around it my whole life, like it's so hilarious on like three levels. He must be so quick to come up with that stuff that fast, and then for you to play along with it, like, yeah, you're right, man. I'm grinding for 60th, and that swing thought's going to get me there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was really funny, and the really funny part was right after I did it. The interview goes out on the Twitter feed, and everybody's looking at it. I couldn't tell you how many young PGA Tour guys came up to me and were just dying laughing because they follow Club Pro guy. I mean, it's some funny stuff, and I hope he continues. I did sit down when we had a big viewing party for the streak. We watched that the other night, the 8-hole par streak. yep, very good. It could be, award-winning, this 8-hole par streak, which is pretty funny.
Was that the week he went 75-75, right, over the to make the cut, I think? 150, like that?
It actually, the 8-hole par streak, I don't want to, spoil it at all for you, but it actually kind of goes over two full tournaments, the end of one tournament and the beginning of the other. So, again, very difficult to keep that streak going. Yeah, especially because you've got 5 or 6 days in between of thinking about that you've already, made five pars. How are you going to make three more?
Yeah, to stay in that sort of a zone. It's I got to watch it. I knew it was coming out. I'm going to have to watch it. I started following it like 3 years ago. My buddy sent me this thing. This is when he used to just send quote unquote like holiday letters to the membership.
Oh, my God.
I don't know if you ever read those old ones.
Oh, yeah.
Tears laughing. And I show this to my wife, and she's like, "I don't get any of the jokes." And it was so good with, like you said, the old referencing of equipment and stuff that's going on. Or if anyone has ever been like an assistant golf pro or golf pro, like the nuances of that letter, I was literally doubled over. So if people haven't followed it yet and you love golf, you've been around it, you got to follow it. Because even like the original stuff was so funny before he was doing kind of real media stuff when he was just writing this to the membership. It was absolutely great. But
yeah,
anyway,
really
keep it up with it, because I enjoy watching your banter back and forth. It's you playing it deadpan and him being serious. It's fantastic.
It's fun.
Yeah, it is. Interesting with, I know you grew up in Sacramento, California area, and how did you start playing golf? How did you get introduced, to the game? And when did you sort of know you were getting good enough to go play at a school like UCLA?
Well, I born in Sacramento, kind of raised all around Northern California. My father played professional baseball as a shortstop, AAA for St. Louis Cardinals and Chicago Cubs. And when he quit playing baseball, he started playing a lot of golf. So when I was born in 65, as soon as I could walk, he was dragging to the driving range and hitting balls. And the golf club was kind of really my first and only toy as a kid. I had this little cutoff club that I'd crawl around and whack a ball around the house. And when I could get outside the backyard, just like walk, I was whacking this golf ball all around. So I started playing very early. I mean, I even started playing, little junior tournaments when I was 3 years old, 4 years old, I was playing in 10 and under junior tournaments. So, you know, I enjoyed golf as a young kid. I was a good player as a junior, won a lot of events, California and Washington and Oregon. But I played all sports growing up. I mean, being an athlete, coming from an athletic family, I played baseball, I played basketball, football all the way up until sophomore year in high school. Played a lot of tennis. So I really wasn't quite just focused on golf, even though golf was kind of my first love, going all the way through my junior years. And then going to UCLA at the time, I was, you know, highly recruited. I was a good junior player, and UCLA was number one in the country. When I went down there, went to a football game at the Rose Bowl and, you know, cruised around Westwood and played Bel Air. I said, you know, this is where I want to come to school. Unfortunately, my golf didn't really blossom at UCLA. You know, again, you get school, and it wasn't quite the way it is now. You know, I was focused on school and other extracurricular activities, and golf wasn't as big a part of my college career as maybe it could have been. And then I quit. All my buddies were turning pro after UCLA, going into the mini tours, and you know, I just wasn't good enough, and so I quit playing golf pretty much cold turkey, and went into the golf business. And you know, I enjoyed doing that, and I was running a lot of golf tournaments, so that kind of at least kept me in golf, playing some scramble events. But that was, you know, as far as being on the PGA Tour, playing golf for a living, that dream was pretty much over after college.
And you had a really good, you had Brant Jobe on that college team. Was there any other guys who ended up playing the tour from that UCLA team you were on?
Duffy Waldorf.
He was on the team.
Duffy was on the team. Brant was on the team. Steve Pate and Corey Pavin were the year before we got there. Jay Delsing, also another player. We had Brad Bell that I played golf with. He played a couple years on tour. And then again, Roger Gunn was also a European tour player and now a very good teacher. So we had a lot of good players on our team. And it was actually tough to make the team. And we carried 17, 18 guys on the team. And, you know, to get in that top four or five was tough. We had a lot of good players.
And you already mentioned this, that you got to play Bel Air. Did you guys kind of get the hall pass to play, you know, L.A. Country Club, Riv, Bel Air when you wanted to? Was that like part of the deal? If you played golf at UCLA, they opened the doors for you guys to those great tracks?
Well, you know, I would say the door was open, but only a little bit. We would play L.A. Country Club on a Thursday once a month. We'd get Riv on a Thursday once a month. We got to play Bel Air twice a week. And then we played some other great golf courses. We played Lakeside once a month on Saturdays, and Brentwood, El Cab. So we played some, you know, some pretty good golf courses around there. But it wasn't like it was just carte blanche. We'd go out there anytime we want. It was specific days and specific times. And if any members came behind us, you had to let them through. So sometimes those rounds could be extremely long.
And like you already kind of mentioned, and I think you've talked about it before in other media stuff, that you kind of worked the golf business before you turned pro during that period of time after college and then your professional career. And the research I did, and tell me if I'm wrong, but kind of finding a method with a long putter sort of convinced you that with that technique, you could actually be a successful touring pro. That was sort of like a turning point where you kind of put that putter in the bag and sort of made that work, and then the light bulb kind of went on, per se?
Well, sort of. I mean, I really wasn't playing much at all. I mean, to be honest, I was playing scramble events and tournaments that I was helping run so I could sell them shirts. I mean, that was my goal, is to sell a tournament, you know, or a company 144 shirts or a foundation and hats. And, you know, that's how I was making my money. So because I had the golf background, I was helping them run the tournaments, and then I would usually, you know, buy a foursome to play. And then 1991, I saw, they had a Champions Tour event, the Raleigh Senior Gold Rush, at my home course, Rancho Marietta, where I lived. And I saw six or seven of these guys putt with a long putter. Out of golf, I hadn't seen anybody using that, even though I guess guys have been using it since about 88. And, that was it. I went home, made one myself, and took it out the next morning, before I went to work, and putted with it. I'm like, you know, this feels pretty good. So putting wasn't my strength at all through college and after college, and that was kind of why I couldn't make it out on the you know, mini tours or PGA Tour. I just wasn't putting. I didn't putt well enough, and so when I got the long putter, I'm like, you know what, this is pretty good. I think I can do this, and I started to entering a couple amateur events, and I won them real quickly, and started, you know, spending a little more time practicing and playing because I was having fun again, just because it was a different method of putting.
And then you turned professional in 92. What was the, because the pathway went pretty quick. You go from turning pro to beating Tom Watson in 96 at English Turn. How did that pathway happen that fast for you to basically start your professional career, Doug, 4 years later, you know, you're beating Tom Watson on Sunday?
Yeah, it's interesting. I turned pro late in 92 just because I went to tour school, missed tour school, and then went to start to work with a gentleman named Dr. Glenn Albaugh, who was a sports psychologist and was the golf coach at the University of Pacific when I was in college. Great guy, wrote a book, a really good book called Winning the Battle Within. And he actually was kind of my mentor and got me thinking better of how to prepare, how to practice like you play, how to think on the golf course. You know, I'd never really done much with sports psychology, so to speak, you know, just kind of wing it and go out there and play. So he, you know, kind of gave me a method, and, you know, he was, you know, kind of the rudder for my ship, steering me in the right direction. And we discovered a lot of great things together. This is really at the start of, you know, kind of Bob Rotella and Coop and Cook and all these guys that were getting together and talking about sports psychology themselves, but how do we apply it to the athletes? So, you know, it was starting to be kind of cutting edge type stuff really early on. And, you know, I jumped in with both feet with Glenn, and he had a lot of great contacts, some guys I got to spend a lot of time with. Because of that, Bill Walsh, who was the football coach of the 49ers, he and Glenn were dear friends. We got to spend a lot of time together. Pete Carroll, at the time, had been a student at University of Pacific and, was one of the students, in Glenn's class that he taught. So we got to spend time together. And then, Glenn grew up with a guy named Michael Murphy, who wrote one of my favorite books called Golf in the Kingdom. And I got to spend a lot of time with Michael over those years. So I got to learn from some of these, you know, guys that had different backgrounds, but, you know, they were all about the human potential and what, you know, you can do with the right attitude and the right mindset.
And obviously, you know, that leads to, you know, beating a legend, Tom Watson, for your first win. Like, so you must have applied it and it worked. But, I mean, kind of looking back at that moment, I mean, to take that step and to have it hold up on Sunday and to beat Tom Watson, that had to be like the most satisfying thing in the world, knowing you were good enough to do it and you did it.
Well, it was a long process. And, you know, I played many tours all around the world, really. I played in Asia. I played the Hooters Tour, the California State Tour, the Golden State Tour. I played anywhere I could play for competition. And then to, you know, so I was able to, you know, apply what I was learning in those mini tours and able to win tournaments there. You know, I always say that there's no difference winning your club championship or a mini tour event in California or Asia or on the PGA Tour or Champions Tour. You have to go through the same feelings and handle your emotions no matter where you're trying to win. You know, it might be a little bigger stage, but it's still the same. So to get in that day in 96 and go against, you know, my boyhood idol, Tom Watson, in New Orleans at English Turn on a really windy day where it's blowing 25, 35 miles an hour, where, you know, Tom Watson could be probably one of the best wind players that ever lived. It was a lot of fun to go up against him and to come out on top. I mean, I was just a young guy. My second year on the PGA Tour, 10 events into my second year. And all of a sudden now I've, you know, got a chance to win a golf tournament against Tom Watson. That was pretty cool stuff.
It has to be, like, what a moment, right? And another legend you're also good friends with, I know, is Greg Norman. And how did you and Greg become friends, and what do you admire about Mr. Norman the most?
Well, Greg and I, you know, when I first got on the PGA Tour, I remember the Hawaiian Open, you know, I'm hitting balls next to Paul Azinger and Payne Stewart, Hale Overland, and all these guys. And I was nervous just to be out there. And I didn't even go in the locker room and change my shoes. I changed my shoes in the parking lot because I was just nervous to be around all these guys that were guys that I looked up to for so long, you know, kind of my heroes. So I said, okay, this is not going to work. Me being nervous around these guys, I got to somehow get to know them. So I started asking guys to play practice rounds, to go to dinner, Peter Jacobson and John Cook and Mark O'Meara and Greg Norman, and just starting to get to know them and becoming friends with them, because I felt if I could get to know them, become friends with them, I wouldn't be nervous out there playing golf with them. You know, it'd just be another guy. It wouldn't be someone that I didn't know. And so Greg was a guy that when I called to say, hey, let's play practice round, let's go to dinner, you know, he was all in. He was happy to, you know, bestow advice to me, as long as you're asking for it. You know, they're not going to give you unsolicited advice or free advice, so to speak. But if you're asking for it, these guys that have been out there a while were more than happy to help some of the young kids. And when we went to Atlanta, 97, to play a golf course that Greg had just designed called TPC Sugarloaf. And so I called Greg to play a practice round since he was a golf course designer. And I ended up winning that week, and he gave me a lot of great advice. And when I finished, you know, I gave him a lot of credit because he did help me quite a bit in learning that golf course. And, you know, ever since then, we became friends. Played a lot of the Shark Shootouts, played in 13, 14 Shark Shootouts, and we did a lot of vacations together and go to the Great Barrier Reef and fishing for black marlin and hunting for elk with bows and all kinds of stuff. So, you know, he's been a guy that I can always call and ask for advice. He'll give me a straight up answer. He doesn't sugarcoat anything. And so, you know, I certainly admire the way he's lived his life. I mean, to the fullest. Every day, you know, it's amazing. You know, his slogan, Attack Life, he really does that every single day. And he's led an incredible life, was an incredible golfer. And now he's an incredible businessman with all the companies that he owns. And I've been fortunate to be able to spend some time with him golfing and, you know, when we're on vacation. And he's a lot of fun, absolute blast to be around, and a great guy to sit and chat and have a beer with.
Yeah, I was going to say, everything he's accomplished, right? If you can't learn something from him from a mentoring standpoint, my gosh, what a career. And like I said, both on and off the golf course, I imagine his knowledge base must be as deep as it gets. What a cool friendship to have.
Yeah, it really is. I really cherish that friendship. And we still, you know, we don't get to see each other as much anymore. It was kind of fun. We got, you know, for that year, we both worked for Fox. So we got to hang out quite a bit together but we still text every couple months and just kind of check up and see where he's doing. And I know now he's got, he's going to do Sirius XM radio, going to have his own radio show now. So I'm really excited for him to do that. It should be a lot of fun and should be an interesting show.
Well, back to your career. Two more wins on the PGA Tour, 97 and 2001. Was that both at TPC Sugarloaf at the Bell South event?
They were, yes. Both of them were at TPC Sugarloaf, correct.
Yeah, so really solid run then for that next 15 years of really consistent play when I was kind of looking back at the information, like I said, for doing this podcast. And to play that well for that long against that competition, what did you do in, let's call it like your 30s, that led to that kind of consistency out there for that period of time?
Yeah, one of the things that, you know, I always drove the ball pretty well. If you can drive the ball and play, you know, you can play just about anywhere. So that was one of my strengths. I always drove it pretty far, fairly straight. I'm not a Fred Funk straight by any means, but I'm certainly a lot straighter than Phil Mickelson. So, you know, if I can drive it fairly long and fairly straight, you know, I'm going to have a good opportunity to play some good golf. So, you know, I played consistent. You know, I still feel when I look back on my PGA Tour career, I wish there were things I would change and things I would do different. But I felt that I threw away, you know, a lot of tournaments coming down the stretch, lost a couple of playoffs that I never should have been in, lost a couple of tournaments coming down the stretch that I never should have lost. Those type of things. So I do have, you know, look back at my career as I didn't accomplish as much as I thought I could. But having said that, I was also selling shirts and had quit golf beforehand. And nobody would have thought that I would have had a 20-something year career playing golf as a professional. So, you know, a lot of people think I'm a huge overachiever, and I think I'm an underachiever. So I guess it's the way you look at it, because I'm still striving to get better. I still want to win tournaments. But I think some of those things that made me consistent was I didn't change too much. I had a very good, you know, mentally, my routine, journaling, the things that Glenn Albaugh and I had worked on, and would start every year over again and relearning just the same stuff over and over again. So I kept it very consistent. I wasn't one to really venture out trying all kinds of new swing theories every week or what's the new swing tip on Golf Channel or Golf Magazine. I kind of stayed, you know, pretty much similar to what got me there. Towards the later part of my career, I had some injuries. And so I started looking a little bit how to change and to see if I could accommodate my swing better to not hurt my right elbow, which I tore a tendon in there in 06. And I think that led to some of the inconsistencies from 06 on. I mean, I was able to keep my card again after my medical, but then I didn't. Then I finished 126, 150 a couple years in a row, and then another injury, and then I was pretty much out. And so my last couple years on the PGA Tour, you know, I was only playing 10 to 12 events because I was in a category that wasn't getting in. And I wish that I would have done some things different at that point to have a little more consistent game and to be able to compete and get ready for that Champions Tour.
Yeah, I was kind of looking back, and in 2012 you didn't start playing as much. I read you had some injuries, but did that also kind of getting that break and getting that time off? I mean, obviously, when you turned 50, you were ready to go. So was there some blessing in disguise on that, too, to let your body kind of rest and really get ready for this next run that you're on as well, of having a little bit of time off and sort of retool and really get focused?
You know, I think so, Jason. I mean, I was playing 12 events, and then I was working for Golf Channel, like 12 events. So working for Golf Channel, I learned a lot, being an on-course commentator, being in the booth, being an analyst. During the morning drives, I mean, I learned a lot. And one of the things I learned is that I love golf and I want to get back and play. I don't want to do announcing for a living just yet. So I think that put a fire under my butt to kind of, you know, gear myself up to get ready to start playing again. Now, the announcing was fun and I would love to do it again when I'm done not golfing. But I was a golfer and that's what I wanted to do. So I think that that actually helped a lot. And I also got to see being an on-course guy, walking with players that were winning and walking with players that didn't win. And you could tell by body language, how they handle themselves, guys that would get upset after a missed shot. You could see them just going on a downward spiral. So that helped me to look at what the best players in the world were doing at the time when they were playing their best. And I learned a lot just by being out there and watching them. It was a lot of fun to watch Jordan Spieth win at Chambers Bay and be there right there with him the whole time, to watch Dustin Johnson win the U.S. Open and to be calling that golf on a major stage. That was really cool. And so that did help me a lot to get ready for the Champions Tour and to get back into golf full time.
Isn't that crazy? After all you've seen, all you've accomplished, you've won on the highest level, and you're still learning from being out there and observing it from a different perspective. That's crazy that it makes sense that you're still gaining knowledge that's helping you in your Champions Tour career by just having a different perspective, even though you've accomplished, you know, winning at the highest level yourself.
Absolutely. I mean, we could always win. And, you know, it's funny. I learn a lot more from losing than I do from winning. And a very smart guy told me that one time that when you're not playing your best, what can you learn? When you fail, you know, yes, I won four times last year on the Champions Tour, but there were, you know, I lost a playoff. I mean, there were some other tournaments that I felt I should have won and didn't come through. You know, I learn more from those things and apply them. And then that can help you spur to even play better. So, you know, when things don't go your way or you miss a shot or coming down the stretch, you know, you don't hit the shot you want. You know, people say you're choking. Well, you know, choking is okay. That just means you're trying hard. But the problem is you're trying too hard. You got to be able to relax and be able to let it go and not worry about too much stuff. And a lot of the stuff that I've applied and worked on over the last couple of years and before I got the Champions Tour I'm able to apply that now. And I worked with a guy named Buddy Biancolana, who was a shortstop for the Kansas City Royals back in the day when they won a World Series. And I worked with him right before I got on the Champions Tour. And a lot of the stuff that we worked on, I'm able to apply every day to play golf and to play golf at the highest level.
Yeah, and you're talking about that, you know, kind of staying in the moment. You're out there, like I said, watching Dustin Johnson win that U.S. Open. For him to get that ruling and then just go play the way he did coming in, like, you know, you're talking about just being able to let it happen and to do it under, not try too hard and just let it come to you. My gosh, to watch that up close must have been, like I said, if you can't learn something from that, of how he handled that, how he played.
Well, really,
how he,
yeah.
Amazing.
It was incredible. And I'll tell you what, I was... A quick little story. So I was the on-course guy. I was there on five when it happened. You know, I obviously did not think Dustin Johnson did anything to move that golf ball. I still don't. And so when he got to 12 and the producer says, hey, you know, they're looking at it. You got to go up there and find a rules official and talk to him. I'm like, well, I'm just going to go talk to Dustin. I know him. So I went right up to Dustin. I'm like, all right, dude, what happened? And he just said to me, he says, yeah, the rules official thinks I moved my ball, but I know I did. So I'm not going to worry about it. I mean, it was like, are you kidding me? You're right here at the U.S. Open. All this stuff is going on. And he just flushed off like, you know, I'm not going to worry about it. And just absolutely flushed this drive on 12. That right there was impressive. I mean, there are a lot of guys on the PGA Tour. And even Jordan Spieth admitted this. If they had come up to him on 12-tee, this was going on, he would have sat down and not hit a shot until they made a decision. I mean, there's a lot of guys that would really have lost that tournament, lost that Open because of what the USGA did to them. And Dustin Johnson just didn't even think about it, just went on his way. I mean, that was impressive.
Yeah, to hit the shots, take it one shot at a time. This has happened. We'll figure it out. And mentally being able to stay in that moment and just play great golf. I was impressed. I mean, I think everyone who follows golf was. How cool is that? It's a very cool story that you were there to actually kind of essentially witness history. And I mean, everyone's going to remember that tournament for how he played, and you know, obviously there's a real change from that. So yeah, correct. You can still learn. That's interesting. It's a great thing about golf, right? You can, the learning process never stops. Well, two more kind of quick topics and we'll get to some quick fires here. Actually, one more topic than quick fires, but I had your cohort Woody Austin on the podcast last week, and he was very passionate about some rules of golf that he thinks he would like to have changed. So I kind of want to get a follow-up to your opinion on this. So
Woody's passionate about a lot of things that don't matter.
Oh, my gosh. It was great. Like, he was like a perfect guy for the podcast. I just kind of, you know, threw it out there and then let Woody run with it and just got out of the way of it. And it was a great conversation. Yeah. But he was saying he misses the golf ball spinning more, meaning that he thinks the golf ball is essentially too good. It goes too straight. It doesn't punish bad shots. You can hit as far as you want off the tee. So would you like to see, for lack of a better word, shot making in more spinning of the ball to create more shots versus kind of the way power golf is played today? I mean, what's your sort of theory on that?
Do you really think all the people listening to your podcast think the ball goes too straight?
No, for the pros.
No.
Yes. So this gets my part two here. What I'll ask is, should it be two sets of rules?
Yeah, I'll tell you what, you know, definitely when I came out in the PGA Tour, when I was playing high school, college, yes, the ball spun more and curved more. There's no question. So we've had to adjust our games to the golf ball, which is a little bit disadvantaged because the young kids coming up never had to do that. They don't know the old golf ball. It's definitely different. I think to take them now and say, okay, you're going to be now playing a ball that's going to curve a bunch and spin a lot more, I think would be a huge adjustment for these young kids now. It would be an easy adjustment for us in the Champions Tour, but, you know, no one really cares about the Champions Tour as much as the PGA Tour. So, you know, I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think they're going to do that. I don't think the ball, you know, needs to go much farther. I think the USGA missed the boat years ago back in 2000 when they could have, you know, put some limits on the golf ball, and they didn't do it. And, you know, they were testing golf balls with wood drivers and steel shafts at 105 miles an hour. I think that was, they completely missed the boat back in the day. To go back now and say, oh, we're just going to roll it back, you know, like Nicholas said, you know, so many percentage. I mean, I think that's ridiculous. I don't think you can do that. You know, let's just kind of curb it, try to stop it from going too much farther. But technology has always been a big part of the game. And, you know, every era and every generation says, you know, the ball's going too far. And you can go all the way back to the 1900s when guys were saying that. So, you know, I don't think, I don't know, you know, now that I'm used to the ball the way it is now, I don't know if I would want to go and go back to a spinnier and curving more shorter golf ball.
Yeah, and he was saying that you'd have to have two sets of rules. Like, you know, I swing a driver at 98 miles an hour. I get what I want. And it's an interesting debate. Should the pros have a ball that essentially played like it did in 1995, right? It's an interesting debate of would it be more interesting or not. But you made a great point that he didn't of what do you do with these guys, 35 and under, 32 and under, who grew up with tight tanks? Yeah. Right, didn't have to, right? Like, I'm teaching my kids, we're going to swing as hard as we can, and we'll figure it out later. You and I probably were taught you swing kind of at 80% and hit a low hook to take the spin off of it. And right, I was taught a different way. And how do you undo what they've been teaching for 15, 20 years at this point? There's the other side of that argument. When they banned anchored putters, what was your thought on that since you used one? And then how long did it take you to figure out what method or to get back to how you're doing it now with not having it anchored but still using the long putter? How did that process work out for you?
Well, obviously when they first were discussing it, you know, I was not happy about it at all. Neither was Adam Scott and Tim Clark and Carl Peterson, all these guys that were using it. We felt that, you know, I've done it since 1991, my entire career. And for the USGA and RA to come in and say, okay, after 21 years, you can't do it anymore, I thought it was ridiculous. And I didn't think it was doing any service to golf. I mean, there was no proof that long putter was easier to putt with. It was just, you know, anchored at the time. We never called it anchored, non-anchored. It was just the long putter. No proof at all. There was no statistical proof that you could putt better. Zero. There was no guys that, you know, were in the top 10 of putting statistics ever, but it helped people that couldn't putt or didn't putt. And it was a different method. Some people putted well with it. Some people couldn't putt at all with it. And it was something you had to learn and you had to practice to get better. They still can't show any statistics where a long putter is better than a short putter. I mean, so for them to ban it because they didn't like the way it looked, and I thought it is still ridiculous. But having said that, because of the ban, you know, I had to search, and I had to search for different ways to putt if I wanted to compete on a Champions Tour. I just turned 50. I played 8 events in the Champions Tour, and then all of a sudden, you know, had to find a new way to putt. So I putted claw. I putted left-handed. I putted, you know, mid-length up the arm. I tried all kinds of things. And it was probably about a 3 or 4 month process of trying to figure out how to do it. And I ended up cutting my putter a little bit shorter, add a little more lead tape on the bottom to bring up the weight. And once I got it shorter and I could figure out how to putt not anchored, and I moved my thumb. I used to have my thumb that went around the grip that would just rest on my chest. And now I had to put thumb on top. And so, you know, the putter angle pretty much stayed the same. So it's, you know, 1 or 2 or 3 inches off my chest. And it took a while, but now I putt better. It's a freer, when I learned how to do it, it's a freer stroke. When I was anchored, if my body stopped, it was very difficult to swing the putter head through because there's no room. But because it's not anchored, if your body stops, there's still a free motion swinging through. So it's actually a better stroke. But it takes practice. It's hard to do. And, you know, you got to really put the time in to do it just like anything. But, you know, guys, I've been putting this way since 1991, forever. It's really the only thing I know. And because of that, just by moving the top grip off 1 inch or 2, didn't really make much difference. It's the same stroke and you're doing the same thing. But if I have a guy that's never used a long putter and I say, okay, go ahead and use it and try to putt with it without anchoring, I think he would have a very difficult time. It would take him a long time, maybe 10,000 hours, to try to get this thing to where he could actually putt.
Yeah, and it's interesting that there's a lot of guys who probably went through that same process, but in the end, they sort of used, let's just call it the long putter, and just move it away from your body a little bit, and you guys are putting pretty – the guys who have taken the time, you know, with you and Longer – putting, the stats look good without it anchored, just letting it go.
Well, if you take last year, Langer had the best putting stats that's ever been recorded, ever. and you know, and on PGA Tour championship ever, and I was second, and that my second stats were the best that ever been recorded. Now, granted, the Champions Tour, our stats probably aren't as perfect as the PGA Tour, but we did putt really well, and I putted great last year. This year, my putter got broken traveling early on in the year, and so I've struggled to find another putter that felt the same. So I finally got it dialed in, and the second half of the season is going to be really good. But the first half has been difficult because a broken putter.
And I also think about that rule change. I mean, I think basically Tim Clark quit playing the tour because of that, right? He said, look, if with my elbow, he's got a hand condition or elbow condition.
Yeah.
He's like, I can't do this. Like, and he's basically killed it a day from that. It's I don't understand it either.
You know, again, he has the elbow condition, but he can still putt not anchored. You know, he can take it off. But again, I don't understand it. Did it help golf? Did it bring more people to it? It didn't. And that was a thing at the time that I was really confused with when I was, I actually had discussions with Mike Davis when we were going through the process. I just couldn't get a straight answer why they wanted to do it. They just didn't like the way it looked. And they were afraid. And the biggest thing that they were afraid of was guys would start anchoring chipping. And they were afraid of the belly putter because so many young kids were using the belly putter. It wasn't so much the long putter, you know, from what Mike Davis told me at the time. It was the belly putter that they wanted to get rid of and 3 points of contact. So the long putter just kind of was thrown in there with it. But the long putter seemed to get the most media attention, especially after when Langer and I were putting really well with it over last year.
Well, the last segment I have here is just sort of some quick fires, whatever come to your mind here. So we'll throw these out there and let me know kind of what comes to your brain on this one. So, best golf shot you ever hit under pressure?
Ooh, you know, I've got two. One was 1994, the final hole at Tour School at Greenleaf, 7-iron out of the right Bermuda rough, and I had to curve it about 20 yards around a tree onto a green with the pin tucked way right, and just hit this, and I was right on the cut line. I had to make par to keep my tour card, and just hit this beautiful cut in 7-iron. This came out nice and soft and landed about 15 feet, and I was able to shake that in 2 putts to get my tour card in 1994. And then the other one was could have been last year at the Allianz Championship, another 7-iron on a par 5, needing the eagle to win the tournament, and hit a great 7-iron to about 6 feet and made that for eagle to win the first tournament last year.
On the flip side, is there a golf shot from another professional that you were playing with that it's the best golf shot you've ever seen? You didn't see that line. You didn't see it. Is there a story of another competitor that just hit a shot that you're still blown away to? You know, today, thinking about it.
Yeah, just about every shot Tiger Woods hit when I played with him back in the day. This guy pulled off so many shots, and the sound of his shots at the time were different than everybody else. You know, he hit a shot on two in Scottsdale. He hit a drive right into the cactus and the trees and hard pan, and I went over there to you know, see his ball and try to help find it. And I looked at this window that he was trying to go through and how much he had to move the ball left to right and you know, kind of keep it low and then had to get it up high. And I mean, I'm like, there's no shot. He's going to chip out. And also I look over and he's got like a 5-iron and he hits this low through this little window riser that cut 40 yards to about 3 feet and made it. I mean, I thought that was one of the coolest shots I've ever seen.
When I've asked that question, his name comes up quite often I'm watching this and I don't see it. I'm a professional and he pulls a shot off that. What planet is this guy from? He's the most common one when I ask it that it pops up.
Yeah, he's good. He's good.
Coolest people or most interesting people you've gotten to meet because of the game of golf that might not be golfers, but just because of what you've done in your career that you've had the pleasure of meeting and some really interesting and great people in your life. Who would those be?
Well, I've been fortunate to be able to hang out with some of the presidents, former presidents of the United States. That's been a lot of fun. I've got to hang out with a lot of athletes. Played with Jerry Rice, a lot of musicians. Got to play with Huey Lewis, the AT&T, every year. We had a blast. I live now in Lake Norman. I get to hang out with one of my heroes, a guy named Dan Jansen, speed skater, Olympic speed skater. We play a lot of golf together, do a lot of stuff together. And, you know, his story is so incredible, being an amateur and going through all those Olympics where he, you know, didn't do as well and failed and fell. And then with his sister dying and falling again and then coming back for a third Olympics and finally winning a gold, and just that determination and perseverance to pull through, you know, when you're not getting paid and you're doing it for, you know, your love of your sport and your country, I think is pretty incredible. And so, you know, hanging out with people like that, that have really done some really neat things. But then, you know, I get to play with all kinds of people in pro-ams, you know, leaders of industries and businesses and doctors and people that are running foundations to help children. I mean, so many interesting people that we've been able to meet are intertwined just because of golf. And I feel very fortunate to meet all these people, whether it's on the course, playing with them, or in the gallery. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, two more quick ones here for you. A fun foursome, I should say this way. You can take three guys from the Champions Tour or current PGA Tour. You guys are going to go play a money game, have a great dinner and a few drinks afterwards at a great golf course. Which three guys are you grabbing, and what do you like about these guys the most?
You know, there's so many guys I go play with. One, you know, Brant Jobe was my college roommate. We've been best buds for a long time. We play every Tuesday. I probably take Brant because we're always partners every week. And then there's so many guys to choose from. I might take Greg Norman, get him back playing some golf, and Peter Jacobson, because we need someone to tell stories the whole time. That would be a good foursome.
Yeah, pretty good group right there. And the last one I have for you, the best three or four golf courses in the world architecturally, in your opinion, and what makes those courses so great?
Well, Pebble Beach is probably my favorite. And what makes it so great is the surrounding area. I mean, looking out in the water, the holes on the water, the uniqueness of the holes. They feel so naturally and sloped with the natural ground. I love Pebble Beach. It's a golf course that I got to play a lot as a kid, and I'm so fortunate to be able to play it as a professional all these years. That's probably one of my favorite. Another one of my favorite is a little golf course in Scotland called North Berwick. Again, you know, kind of a Seth Rayner, Redan Green. They just throw all kinds of stuff in there. And my wife and I are going to go over and play it right before we play the British Senior Open this year, which is at St. Andrews. And we're going to go over early and play North Berwick. And then I would have to say St. Andrews, just because, you know, it's the home of golf. And the feelings I get being there and playing, I get to play at Dunhill. I played there a few times. It's just so cool. I love that little town. Just to be able to walk around and, you know, have dinner and have a pint. Go to the little Jigger Inn there for a burger and a pint, and play the golf course. It's the home of golf. It's pretty cool.
Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time today, Scott, to be on the podcast. I greatly appreciate it. Play well the rest of the season. We'll be watching there for you, and I'll probably see you out at Exmoor, as I think we're going to be covering that. So look forward to watching you play, you know, in a major championship near our hometown. So great rest of the year, and thanks again for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.